and dozens of community meetings. Michigan residents told the Center for Michigan they face a catch-22 situation when it comes to college. In the past, many Michigan families believed that high school education was enough. That's no longer the case. Now, 9 in 10 Michigan families believe college or other training after high school is a very important stop on the path towards prosperity. But more than half say a college degree is only somewhat or not worth the cost. So there's a sticker shock today. College costs and families' ability to pay those costs have moved in opposite directions. Average one-year tuition has increased 86% since the turn of the century at Michigan's 15 public universities. This is just tuition, not including room and board and other costs. At the same time, median household income in Michigan has increased 24%. So how did we get here? Well, for starters, it's worth noting that college costs have been on the rise for a long time, and not just in Michigan. Let's take a walk through time and get a glimpse of how culture and college costs have changed throughout America. The year is 1975. Watergate and the end of the Vietnam War dominated national headlines. NBC premiered a new game show called Wheel of Fortune. Jimmy Hoffa disappeared. The Ford Mustang was cool. And Captain and Tennille sing the year's number one song. The American college sticker price felt the same as $8,000 today. A year of college was the equivalent of 14% of the average American family's yearly income. Welcome to 1985. Teenagers played cassette tapes on their new Sony Walkmans. Microsoft launched its first version of Windows. The wreck of the Titanic was discovered. Coca-Cola nearly sank itself by changing its classic soda formula and introducing New Coke. And Michigan's own Madonna shot to the top of the charts with this hit song. A year of college felt like $8,400 in today's dollars. It took 16% of the average family's annual income to pay that college tab. Ahead we move on to the go-go 1990s. Toy Story's Woody and Buzz Lightyear were big hits on the big screen. O.J. Simpson was found not guilty. Lady Di and Prince Charles filed for divorce. And Coolio declared a gangster's paradise. I'm the kind of nigga that a homie's gonna be like on my knees in the night, saying prayers in the streetlight. A year of college cost about $10,700 in today's dollars. It took 20% of the annual family income to foot the bill. 2005, Harry Potter captivated our imaginations in print and in movie theaters. Hurricane Katrina saddened the nation. The war in Iraq dominated the news. And Brad Paisley encouraged country music fans to get a little mud on their tires. Cost of a year of college grew to $14,310. it took a full quarter of annual family income to cover the college bill. This brings us all the way up to 2014. Jay Leno left the Tonight Show and didn't come back. The United States normalized relations with Cuba. The Ice Bucket Challenge raised more than $100 million. Workers and students go five-hour energy to stay awake, and Pharrell told us all why he was happy. And college costs kept rising. The price tag for a year of college rose to just under $19,000. And it took more than one-third of a family's annual income to cover those costs. So what's the end result of all this? A different kind of college hangover. More and more families are using student loans to make up the difference between what college costs and what they can pay. Consider the impact here in Michigan. Annual student loans taken out by students at Michigan's public universities have more than doubled since the turn of the century. Michigan University students are on pace to take out $2 billion in student loans just this year. The one-year student loan debt in Michigan is approaching $7,000 for each student. This figure has also more than doubled after adjusting for inflation since the beginning of the 21st century. What does the Michigan public have to say about all this? In community conversations across the state, high cost is the most commonly cited challenge to completing college. Rising tuition and student debt are the public's highest college affordability concerns. And what does Michigan public want to do about it? Several things, including deeper state investment. A majority of Michigan residents favor funding public colleges and universities at higher levels to make them more affordable. More accountability and efficiency on campus. Nearly 9 out of 10 Michigan residents call for it in community conversations and polls. Ease the path. More than 8 in 10 favor more students earning college credits while still in high school. Change the financial aid. The public favors new innovations like pay-to-stay and pay-it-forward tuition plans. Now it's your turn. After hearing from the governor and watching this presentation, what are some of your opening thoughts or questions about college affordability today? Before we turn to our jam-packed schedule of panelists, we'd like to hear from you.
Thank you. Does everybody want to hear Happy again so you can dance a little bit? Good morning, I'm John Bebo, President and CEO of the Center for Michigan. We hold a lot of conferences like this, and there's always a complaint there's never enough time for audience interaction. So we're turning things upside down, and we're going to start with audience interaction. You've been able to hear from the governor this morning, and he has challenged us all to be innovative. And we've kind of laid out our little brief lecture on college affordability here. You also have in front of you the report that led to today's conference. After the center held about 160 community meetings across the state, and conducted several polls on this topic. The governor's right, school counseling is among, and career navigation is one of the key issues that we talked about at a conference in Livonia about 4 weeks ago. But for now, we are open for dissension for the next little while. We're going to have a lot of speakers today, including the three university presidents, some national experts on college affordability and value. But first, I'd like to introduce Phil Power, Chairman of the Center for Michigan. Jack Delphi, former state budget analyst and former president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, and Amber DeLynn, who is for the circus that is holding 160 community meetings in 1 year. But we are open to the floor for your questions, your comments about what you saw on the screen here, what the governor had to say, what some of your questions or issues are that you'd like to hear from the panelists this morning. And it is wide open. We're violating the first rule of politics, which is don't take a vote until you know the answer. Mark Burnham has a question in the back. Haley has the microphone for you. We do have mics coming around.
Good morning. First of all, thank you for hosting the event. I think it's wonderful that we get an opportunity to be here. One of the challenges, and first of all, I do appreciate the overview that was provided. What it doesn't provide, however, is a discussion about why those tuition costs went up, at least in Michigan as it pertains to the public universities. From House Fiscal Agency's own data, it is very clear that the 15 public universities' tuition only went up $243 above inflation over a 13-year period. The entire switch of who paid was a direct derivative of the fact that the state divested in higher education over the last 15 years. They've been divesting for a lot longer than that, but just in the last 15 years alone, we've seen a switch where the state's paying half of what they were per year, and the students are paying double. So I think it's helpful to have the overview, but if you don't have the understanding of why the numbers went up, it's harder to get at the solution. So I think we need to bring that up first.
That's a great point. I'm glad you raised it, Mark. The report notes that 60% of the tuition increases over the past generation are attributed to the decrease in state support, according to our state fiscal analysts. That's noted in the report. And that's exactly the kind of dialogue and clarification we're hoping for in some of this open discussion. Thank you. John Austin, now president of our State Board of Education.
I just wanted to extend Mark's comments. This basic bargain about who pays for our really fantastic public higher education system, America's greatest strength, is not just a Michigan concern, but the basic bargain since World War II was, look, the Fed would help fund basic research, which is so powerful that we benefit from new discovery and modest financial aid for poor people. But it's up to the state to fund access to provide a high-quality, low-cost education at our great public universities and community colleges. As Mark says, that we're not alone. The states have walked back that commitment, just a share of our income to put in paying that bill. And we also, another point too, I hope we'll talk about later, it's still a good investment to go into debt to get that degree, because you do, as the governor said, earn more if you complete a credential. It's those who have not completed a credential, post-secondary certificate or degree, who are in serious trouble and who are the ones suffering most from this crushing debt burden.
Here's a thought for both Mark and John. I served for 11 years as a regent of the University of Michigan. And when John referred to the basic bargain, there's one that goes back farther even than that between the Fed and others for the basic research. 30 years ago, there was a general view in this country that the country had an obligation to invest in the skills and talents and capabilities of its people. Today, that deal has largely fallen apart, and tuition at universities has become a system of user fees paid by students who are interested in optimizing their income upon graduation. When I first went on the University of Michigan's Board of Regents, the ratio between student fees and tuition and state support for the university was about 50-50. 11 years later, when I left the board, the ratio was 25% state support and 75% student and fees. I remember when my father was on the Board of Regents, the ratio was 75% state support and 25% students. So something significant has happened over this 30-year period, a change in public policy and attitude having to do with society's obligation to improve itself. Now, having said that, having been a member of governing board of the university, I also believe there's a long way that universities can go to improve their financial performance and their management of scarce assets. Those of you who have gone to class at 8 a.m. on Monday mornings have a pretty good idea of what I'm talking about. Thanks.
I'm Doug Klein. I'm the executive director of the Mason Area Chamber of Commerce. And I was speaking with Phil before our meeting today that I was meeting with a small businessman this morning already. And he expressed an additional complication with our current situation. He's a small business IT guy, and he is looking for new employees. As part of his employment process, he does a credit check on his new employees. He's reluctant now to hire employees who have huge student loan debts. So education certainly is a key to getting a better job, but there might be an additional barrier with these high loan situations.
So I'd be interested to know, too, if that is a widespread problem all over, and I want to build on Phil's comment, too, about funding. I mean, I think nationally we've stepped away from some of our obligation in higher ed, but in particular in Michigan, Michigan now ranks 46th among the 50 states in support on a per pupil basis. And I think that if we want to be a top state in this measure, it's going to be very difficult to do if we're a bottom state in state support for higher education.
Thank you, Jen. Keep those questions and ideas coming.
Hi. You know, one of the things that I'm understanding is part of the debt problem is that students are graduating from college and having a difficult time finding employment because of perhaps some of the career paths that they chose. So this once again goes back to the career guidance and career counseling that needs to start back once again in the high school. When the governor said, you know, let's be innovative and think outside the box, and he referenced several times private sectors, online guidance, how is that going to help students when they're confused just applying to colleges? The online is overwhelming, it's stressing them out, and we need to revert back to investing in our students and giving them the time and attention that is needed to give them the help that they need to get to where they gotta go.
Thank you for the comment. I'm looking at the table next to you where Brandy Johnson. Brandy, could you stand up for a minute? Brandy runs what used to be known as the Michigan College Access Network. It has a new name. Brandy, what's the new name?
Well, Michigan College Access Network still exists. We did not go away, but our program is called Advise Michigan.
Okay, thank you. If you haven't heard about it, I really encourage you to look at what Brandy's doing. I think it speaks to the governor's challenge for innovation. Her organization has helped put dozens of dedicated career counselors in Michigan high schools. These are recent counseling graduates of our universities who are now in high schools solely for the reason of providing career and college guidance counseling at a time when that wasn't happening very much at all. I think it's a great program. I just wanted to recognize you for what you're doing.
Just a thought, Brandy, you may have some added detail you want to add to that because you're the great authorities. But a consequence of the Great Recession and stress in K-12 schools is, as I understand it, we now have one high school counselor per 600 high school students. That's in the aggregate. And that's not a recipe for a whole lot of counseling. Randy, I'm sure you have thoughts about that.
Yeah, on the K-12 level, it's actually 1 to 700 if you look across the whole K-12 spectrum. In high school, it's probably closer to 1 to 400, which is still ridiculous. The recommended ratio in high school, because of this added dimension of college and career counseling, is 1 to 250. So in an ideal scenario, we would absolutely hire more school counselors to get our high school student counselor ratio to that 250 to 1 level. In the short term, we have found ways to supplement school counselors by hiring these dedicated college advisors who, at much lower cost, can help students, at the very least, navigate the process of identifying a career goal, figuring out what skills are needed and education is needed to reach those career goals, and then really helping students navigate the transition. And they work right alongside school counselors, usually under the supervision of school counselors, and it's been a huge game changer and capacity builder for our high schools. Today we have about 80 advisors serving 100 high schools between my program, Advise Michigan, the Michigan College Advising Corps, and the MSU College Advising Corps. Thank you.
Thank you, Brittany. Hi, over here. Hi, Jen. I'm Lon Rodel. I'm a self-employed photographer in Ann Arbor. I used to work at the News with Jen, and I used to cover Phil when he was a regent at U of M. And then the News went under, and now I'm working for myself. But I also have a sophomore at U of M, a senior and a sophomore at Skyline High School in Ann Arbor, and I taught for 5 years at Washington Community College. So my observation is that both my daughters were 4.0s. My senior in high school is still a 4.0. Took AP classes in high school, got 5s on the tests, and didn't necessarily see that those credits transferred over to U of M. And when I taught at Washtenaw, the other thing I noticed was a lot of kids were EMU students that had to go to Washtenaw because EMU didn't offer the courses they needed to take. And so they were going to two schools, paying two tuitions, albeit Washtenaw was cheaper than EMU. Or they were at Washington on those courses that they then would try to transfer over to U of M or EMU or wherever they were going to go to college to finish, didn't always transfer. So they were doing everything right, and yet it still wasn't working for them. And so that's just an observation that I'm making as a dad and as an instructor. And I just wondered, is there some way that that could be regulated so that when you do take an AP class and get a 3 or higher, or you do go to Washington or any other community college, that those transfers credit or credit to you when you transfer over to a higher education to finish your degree?
Ron, thanks for a great question. And Ron is serving as our average Michigan parent today. He's also our official photographer for the event, so this is interactive journalism. I'm going to turn to Jeff on this, who's actually moderating our last panel of the day that deals with things like credit transfer and smoothing the process. Would you like to respond?
Sure. So there are definitely some strategies that can help with that. In particular, some schools, some states have implemented bulk transfer, where if you complete a community college degree, you sort of can transfer to the four-year institution and take your 60 credits with you, pretty much no questions asked. Michigan has the Michigan Transfer Network in place, which is supposed to make it easier for students to figure out which classes transfer. So there are definitely strategies that are put in place. I think there's also the trade-off, though, that it can be difficult if you're an institution of higher education and you think your degree represents something. How many credits do you let somebody bring in from another institution, without thinking that maybe they're not getting the same experience? But clearly this is a problem for students, and we can do better. I think the state is working on it, particularly with that transfer network, and I think the bulk transfer strategy has some real potential also.
Jeff and Amber, is it your sense that Lon's question is pretty common in what you heard in community meetings? And Jeff, is it your sense at all that this kind of discussion is intensifying at the policy level as cost pressures rise on families?
So Lon's question is one that a lot of participants in the state made when we were doing these community conversations. So if you're looking through your report, on page 10, that's actually one of the recommendations of the public, is to kind of use the power of college credit to offer high school students more opportunities to earn college credit while in high school. However, if those credits aren't then transferring to the institutions where they want to attend, then we'll do them as much good as we would hope. So I think that fits right into some of the discussion we'll be having today, and it's certainly on the minds of Michigan residents.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's a very big discussion right now, and we're getting a little better at it as a state, which I think is encouraging.
I'm David Price. I'm a trustee for Saranac Community Schools. And one of the things I'd like to address is for the financial aid aspect of help that we can give to families and their children to afford college. One of the things that from a grassroots level has kind of emerged is promise programs. It started with Kalamazoo, expanded it into other states, Michigan, Baldwin, you have Lansing, you have Grand Rapids. Governor Granholm signed legislation enacting promise zones. I just saw that the Senate passed a bill to expand it even further in Michigan potentially. So one of the things I'd like to see is a discussion on how we can empower and expand things like the promise zones from a grassroots level to help kids afford to go to college. Thank you.
That's a great point, that Jeff, I'll turn to you in just a second. Ron French from French Magazine, are you here in the room somewhere? Okay. Ron writes about education issues for Bridge and has written fairly extensively about Promise Scholarship programs. I refer you to some of his recent coverage along those lines. If you're interested, Jeff, do you have any additional thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is a big issue for the state on the financial aid front. We basically eliminated most of the state funding for financial aid when we were in the last recession, including the Promise Scholarship. The state was spending about $200 million a year in state funds. And most of what we spend now at the state level, and universities provide their own, we're using TANF dollars for. So we really eliminated state support there. So that a lot of the support that you are seeing are some of these local promise programs, and there's a lot of potential there. But the governor alluded to it that, you know, funding financial aid is a very effective strategy to increase college attainment. And at least as a state, as part of our cutting that we've done in higher ed, financial aid is one of the places that it's seen a significant cut. And so when we look at trying to increase attainment, that's a good place to invest. Whether it be state providing funds to help support some of these local promise zones, expanding what they do, or just, you know, putting more money into state financial aid programs.
But there is an added kind of hidden issue in many of these promise programs. The one I know the most about has to do with the Kalamazoo Promise, which has been a huge success. One of the less recognized consequences of that program is that kids who graduate from Kalamazoo Public Schools then apply and are admitted to four-year institutions, and they then discover that their high school training isn't adequate to sustain them for a four-year degree. They, in turn, then are often directed back to Kalamazoo Valley Community College, for example, for remediation. And the people at KVCC have had trouble trying to deal with the unexpected inflow of kids who need to be remediated. So what we have is a situation which begins in high school, which gets to community college, which gets to universities. At least as far as I'm concerned, I like very much Governor Snyder's conception of how to think about higher education, not as a system of silos, but as a P20 system in which we think about the subject as investing in human capital, regardless of which silo the investment is coming in.
We have time for a few more questions. We're going to take a quick break before the university presidents join us here on the stage at 10:15. But please keep a few more questions coming in. I see Arnold Weinfeld here.
Thank you, John. Just a couple of observations because this is very complicated. One of the factors surrounding students taking longer than 4 years, of course, is the higher cost, which presents us with a catch-22. So you don't just have students that don't know what they want to be when they grow up going to college, but you have many students coming from families where wages have been not keeping pace with the cost, where the flip in state investment as compared to student investment in a college education means that they have to work their way through college. So that's a major reason, I think, why students are taking 5 years. At the end of the day, there's no substitute for direct investment by the state in college education. In terms of parent perception or student perception about some of our skilled trades work or manufacturing jobs, I don't know so much as it's seen as a dirty job still, but I think more that the volatility in manufacturing over the last decade, where kids that are now entering college when they were younger children and teenagers saw their parents or friends of parents, especially in this state, lose their jobs, I think is a major factor in them determining that they don't want to see that go into that as a field. And last but not least, I've heard a lot of discussion about work at the high school level in terms of career counseling or getting kids some experience. I think we got to push that down to the middle school and even the upper L level. I remember when I was at that age, you know, there was the field trip to this industry or that business. to try and get kids thinking about, you know, what they might want to be when they grow up. But we hear a lot about time constraints these days in the classroom to do those things. So I think that we need to give younger children an experience in the world of work that might be out there as they grow up. So as they get into high school, they're maybe already thinking that way. So not just at the high school level, but we need to do some counseling and career guidance, I think, all the way down to the middle school level.
Thank you, Arnold. I need to correct one thing I just said, and this is especially for the university staffs who are here today. I made a mistake. Our university president's panel begins at 10:30, not 10:15. So we're going to take questions until 10:15. So if I just scared any of you, I apologize. 10:30, not 10:15. Please keep the questions coming for a few minutes.
We got one right here. Over here.
Hi, I'm Dylan Dodds at the University of Michigan. I've been watching the state of Michigan budget for a long time, and I think one thing that's really important to keep centered when we're talking about investment in higher education is, and some people doubt that there's a connection here, but I just want to quickly say that, is watching the changeover. There was a critical change, I think, in the late 90s or early 2000s when the corrections budget overtook the higher education budget. And today, I think all of us now clearly understand that there are major social and educational issues involved, and this is where it hits hardest. Our communities of color, where African American, Latino, and Native American students are performing at levels that chronically are lower. And one of the reasons for that, as we can see, is the school-to-prison pipeline, where school behavior is criminalized and incarcerations happen much more frequently. So one of the things I think that we need to keep in mind is keeping an eye on the corrections, the ratio between the corrections budget and the higher education budget. Right now, higher education is lower. It used to be higher. Hopefully one day that'll flip again.
That's an excellent observation. And Jeff, I'm going to turn to you to give a little more perspective. But that's exactly why Center for Michigan and a variety of policing groups in the room here of nonprofit and business groups have scrutinized the prison budget since about 2008 because it's been crowding out many other priorities. But Jeff, do you have some additional thoughts on that?
Sure. So we've got two things that have gone on there. One is Michigan spends a lot of money on corrections. I mean, you're right. In particular, you've seen some interest again in reforming this, but we tend to incarcerate people longer for the same offenses than other states. And that costs a lot of money, and so we've seen, you know, a significant state expenditure on that front. There were some changes made at the end of the Granholm administration with respect to parole that lowered that a little bit, but there's obviously still work to be done there. The other thing is that when we were in the middle of the recession and cutting, higher education was seen as an easy place to cut. You know, when you cut the corrections budget, you have to let people out of jail at some point. When you cut the higher ed budget, you can look to the universities to raise tuition to make up some of that. And the state leaned heavily on that lever. And so we saw very significant cuts to the amount of GF money that the state spent on higher education, and we saw very significant increases in college tuition as a result of that.
Jeff, you also hear, maybe not openly on stages like this, but you do hear occasionally from policymakers who they look at the overall appropriations as a ratio of the university budget today, and it has decreased. And I think in some policymakers' minds, there's a sense of, well, appropriations are doing so little for universities today anyway, a little more cut might not hurt. What is your response to that? I've heard that around town, and I wonder what you think of that.
So, you know, the governor alluded to the fact that you've got to make decisions about where to invest in when he was talking about investing in early childhood, and I think the question is, you know, how valuable is investing in higher education? And again, you know, if we want to be aspirational as a state, you know, we rank 46th in funding per pupil on for four-year institutions of higher education. If we want to be a top state, if we want to be one of the best, right, and we want to have, the best outcomes at our universities and the most graduates, and we're not going to get there at 46. I mean, you know, maybe we can't afford to get to one, but we get out of the bottom five, it seems.
Who is first, by the way?
That's a good question. I don't actually know that. But while you're talking, I'll look it up.
Hi, my name is Brenda Ammon, and I have two students that come down to the Ross School of Business, and I have two that about 14, 46 and people support. I like what Mr. Howard says about how we can streamline our system. I also like what Governor says about leveraging our assets. We talked about building and equipment, but I think how about our high school teachers that are already adjunct instructors of our universities? How can we use them in our high schools? Actually, this has been being done across the country where college courses are actually taught in high schools by high school teachers that are credentialized by NAACP. And the kids get the college credit while they're in their own high school. And then these college classes are put on a transcript and the kids take those off to college. It's being done by Big Ten universities such as University of Minnesota, Indiana University, Connecticut University, which is a land-grant university like Michigan State, has been doing it since 1955. They reach 10,000 students in their credit amount of programs, and it just reaches a very wide range of students. And it's an incredible value for parents, families. The teachers get acquainted with the colleges and get streamlined and provide benefits off.
Jeff, that sounds like a topic that may come up in your panel later today.
So, I admit I missed the question because I was looking up who the top spending people. I do have the answer to that question when you're ready for it.
Man, we are working you hard today, aren't we? The question was, can high school teachers teach college courses? Is there room for that? Is that pragmatic at this point? Other states are doing it.
So, anyway, you can do some of that, right? You can see this with AP classes. And so, and earning high school, earning college credits while you're in high school is a good way to help kids graduate in 4 years. I mean, there's no question about that. But that's good on the college attainment front. But I will, like I say, tell a personal anecdote. You know, I took AP Computer Science when I was in high school. And, you know, got a high enough score on the test that I came into U of M with 4 credits, which was good. But then realized once I got to U of M that my AP class was not as strong as Introduction to Computer Science class at U of M, and so I couldn't take the next class. So I was sort of turned out. So there is a risk with that.
And who ranks number one in appropriations for students?
So number one is Alaska at $18,000 a kid. So that's clearly a little bit of an outlier. But, you know, if you get to the top 13 states, they're all spending more than $8,000 per pupil, and Michigan is at $4,200. So we are significantly below the top states.
Throw out a few names for us.
The top 10 are Alaska, Wyoming, Hawaii, Connecticut, Illinois, North Carolina, North Dakota, New York, Nebraska, New Mexico.
We got another one over here.
Hi, good morning. My name is Nicole Johnson. I work in the Office of Admissions for a public university, but specifically for students in Detroit. And one thing that I see quite a bit is students who are dual enrolled, but they're actually failing some of their high school courses. So my question is, we've had a conversation where we talked about this on the counselors inside of the high school, and even with the admission people, it's unrealistic that they'll be able to have a conversation with every single student in high school. So instead of pushing students to be dual enrolled, has there been any conversation about adding actual courses to high school curriculum that will be a career exploration course or a financial literacy course, and that way they can have an entire semester to learn about this as opposed to just one conversation throughout their entire school?
That's a great question, and actually that particular recommendation was one of the public's recommendations in our most recent round of conversation. So as has been mentioned a few times this morning, one of the key topics of our most recent round of community conversations was career navigation, and that exact recommendation that students, all students in high school, receive some sort of coursework or curriculum on discernment and choice making and career exploration is a recommendation of the Michigan public. You know, I am not certain, and perhaps I can look at my fellow panelists to know whether that's been considered or if there's anyone that has proposed doing such a thing, but I know that that is something that Michigan residents would really like to see.
I'm staring at John Austin here. Common Core was continues to be a titanic struggle in Michigan. But we're hearing this repeatedly now. One of the questions from the audience to the governor was about financial literacy. Should that be required? We did hear in our community meetings a real strong sense from the public that kids don't have a real clear path on what the economy is, what a job is, how to get training for it. John's going to be on stage with us later. Hopefully he can address this, but I think it is an open question for some of our panels. Is there more that we need to do to open up curriculum and change it to address some of these concerns? Ken Winter, Stephanie, come on, and Ken Winter has a question.
Hi, this is Stephanie Kohlmeyer, the director of the Michigan Talent Investment Agency. I just wanted to comment on the dual enrollment and just to alert folks in the audience that this year, actually, this fiscal year, there's an additional $10 million to go support middle colleges. So a student can earn both an associate's degree, an industry recognized credential, at the same time earning their high school diploma. So they're more college ready and more job ready as well. And we really are looking forward to seeing what the results of that program are and looking to expand it if it's the results we expect. Thank you.
Not really a question, but a clarification. At least in my area, my name is Ken Winter. I'm a former editor and publisher of the Petoskey News Review, and I'm working with Phil and John right now. But we already have an early college experience, at least in Petoskey. I'm a liaison for the Gaylord High School from North Central Michigan College. I think we have five high schools now that offer classes within the high school.
That's a great point, Ken. And our final panel today is going to talk a little bit more about how to bring more of those efforts to scale. Thank you for bringing it up.
Hi, I'm Erin Shore with the Community College Association. I just want to double back to a point that we referred to briefly about students graduating from high school and then realizing that they're not prepared for those college-level courses. And at the community college level, I just double-checked the Michigan dashboard, 61% of our students requiring at least one developmental education course. Now, that does include large numbers of returning workers. Our average age is about 26, and I know there's math I can do at 18 that I cannot do now. But that is absolutely a piece of the affordability conversation. If we are asking for students to pay for something, again, at the college and university level, that they should have had already in high school, that's costing more. And all of the evidence shows that the more levels of developmental education they have to go through, the less likely they are ever to get a credential of any sort. So I think we need to keep that conversation there. I know our K-12 partners are doing the best they can with limited resources, but we all just saw the same MCAP results, and we have a long way to go.
On this point, I'll give you a personal example of how to say something that really gets you in lots of trouble. When I was a regent of the University of Michigan, we began to think about this problem, and it's not a small problem, because a lot of cases, if you get admitted to the university and they get there, it turns out that they need some extra help in order to deal with the coursework. At that point, I made a modest suggestion that students who couldn't manage college work and needed to be remediated should be remediated, that's fine, but the graduating institution should be required to pay for the remediation. That was not a popular point of view in many sectors.
Let's take two more questions, and then we'll take a quick break before our university president and business leaders from Michigan join us at 10:30.
Sure. Tom Speakman, Central Michigan University. I think two variables that we haven't talked about would be, one, the declining high school demographic in the state of Michigan. I think we're number two in the nation in terms of the most significant decline of high school graduates. So the partnership elements, when you talk about partnering, we're also competitors as well, and I think that's a part that really needs to be addressed. And I think the second piece is the number of high school graduates that leave the state of Michigan to go to another four-year institution, and how do we make it attractive to keep the declining high school graduates in the state of Michigan.
You get the last word.
Oh my goodness, that's a lot of pressure. My name is Megan Niasty, and I currently work at St. Clair County Resa, but I did spend a significant amount of years in higher education at a public institution. And something that I always found talking about early and middle college and dual enrollment even is that students, when they're taking these classes, again, they don't know exactly what they want to do. So their credits may transfer to that college university, but it doesn't go towards any of their degree programs. So they're stuck taking an additional year or 2 years. So, you know, I've seen this happen time and time again where students are just taking courses because, well, I'm in this early college program and that's what I'm supposed to be doing. but not necessarily it's not connecting if they decide they want to go on to a four-year school. So I think there needs to definitely be more of a conversation about that. As well as students, do they value the school that they're getting? You know, I think this goes back to a conversation about why do students want to go to college? When I was looking at colleges, it was, well, that's just what I'm going to do. I'm just going to go to college. I didn't really know why. It was just the next step. Everyone told me I had to go to college. So I think students sometimes are going to college without a plan, and then they hang around for 5 or 6 years, and they're like, well, I have a degree in history now, or, you know, without any type of what they want to do with that degree. So I think there needs to definitely be more of a conversation about that career, as well as what do you want to do? Let's have a plan. So, again, middle school, elementary school, talking about it, everything. So
thank you very much for this discussion. I'd like to provide a sense of context at this point in what we're about, because it has a great deal to do with the work that we do at the Center for Michigan. Much of our work has to do with what we call public engagement. And since we started holding these little community conversations all around the state back in 2007, we have involved more than 40,000 Michigan residents in these community conversations, which is certainly the largest public engagement program in Michigan history and maybe one of the biggest around the country. The point of this program is to find a way in which citizen views can be called forth and then amplified through our journalism in Great Magazine so that they come to the attention of policymakers. So that's for years been the point of these community conversations, to link them together with journalism through Great Magazine. Today's conference and the two previous ones that we had last month take this process one step farther, because we are now interested in connecting the views of Michigan citizens as expressed in our community conversations and expressed by you today, and bringing them together with experts so that we convert a public engagement campaign into a citizen engaged policy process, which will result in suggestions we will be making to the legislature and to the governor next January. And it's a way of opening the policy process in the state to citizen engagement, citizen knowledge, and participation, which will make Michigan a better place. That's what you're doing here today, and thank you for coming. John, how do you want to manage? Want to take a break? Tell me what to do.
10-minute break, and then we will start precisely at 10:30.
Precisely, folks.